no dejaremos que cierren la linda puerta que siempre ha estado abierta a la vida.
You're listening to Latin Radical with Warwick Fry.
This week we talked to Tim Anderson, and he's just produced a film about the Cuban medical presence in East Timor. I think there's 1,000 East Timorese students who went to Cuba to be trained, and it's very much a part of the Cuban process, if you like. And how's it going?
Just a couple of little things on that. It's a very personal film, I think, and it's mainly about the students, also to some extent about the Cubans, but it's mainly about the Timorese students who are getting the opportunity, courtesy of the Cubans, to study medicine. There has been 1,000 scholarships offered, but so far there's about 850 take-ups. 700 of them are in Cuba studying now. They're the ones I was visiting there late last year. And there's 150 now studying in Timor, visited some of them last year too. So they're the main characters in the film. It's really about them and to some extent their families and also some of the doctors they're training with.
And last time we spoke, Tim, we did speak about the Cuban doctors in East Timor. You were sent round a petition or asking the Australian government if they could match this level of medical assistance to the Timorese.
Yes, that's right. We sent about 20 of us signed a letter, people who were academics, people in NGOs, people who are working in health and East Timor and Aboriginal communities, to match the scholarship offer, not necessarily the medical offer, because I think really effectively the Cubans are carrying it all in terms of training at the moment, or 95% of it, but at least scholarships in other areas. I mean, they need trained teachers. There's a lot of areas where human capacity building is needed there, and it seemed that the Rudd government, if it was not going to do anything else different to the previous government, was talking up education and might still do something substantial in the scholarship area, and a lot of us wanted them to, rather than just ignore or snipe at the Cubans' presence in the region, as the unfortunately a lot of people are doing, and the previous government of course did. Instead of doing that, to match that generosity with another 1,000 scholarships from here, because a lot of us of course work in, like myself, work in the education sector too, and we know we've got a lot of capacity here. We could easily offer 1,000 scholarships. It needs to be done in a different way, that's all, to the way it's being done at the moment.
Any signs that this will be met or agreed to? Or?
Well, I believe that they are still working on some way of expanding the scholarship scheme, but I haven't. We wrote that letter 5 or 6 months ago, or 5 months ago, and I haven't got any response yet, you know, not even a letter saying, thank you know, we're looking into it, we'll get back to you. Usually they have staff members and public servants to write these letters. I haven't got one after 5 months. I have heard, though, someone at the Timorese embassy told me that the number of scholarships has increased for Timor. It is now at 12 per year. Back at the time of independence, it was 20 per year. In the last couple of years of the Howard government, it was 8 per year. I'm told reliably that there is 12 scholarships per year from AusAid. Now, that's very, very small. It might be that there's something else in the pipeline. I suspect that there is, but I don't really know what it is yet.
And just tell us a little bit about this film. You know, you said it was a very personal project on your part. You know, what got you going on this?
Well, it was just a personal interest. I mean, I've been involved to some extent with trying to link up people with these programs, but of course the Timorese did it all themselves, and I was just observing it from a bit of a distance. But I kept coming across the program. For instance, myself and my partner, by coincidence, were in Havana in December 2005 when the former Prime Minister Mari Alkatiri arrived there and met with the Cuban government, and a bunch of Timorese students came down to meet him in Havana. And at that stage, that was when the program was really being ramped up from an initial 50 scholarships to 300 and then to 1,000. I realized that it was really becoming a massive program, really. And I was very interested in some of the personal stories. Being a teacher myself, on some of the personal stories of the young people from the village who were getting a chance to go to university, a unique chance to go to university. And I've known some of them who had a lot of difficulty just trying to get a scholarship to come and say to Australia or anywhere else. So, and I was in a rather unique position in the sense that I was already researching in Timor and in Cuba. And so I had the opportunity to go and visit these young people if I made the effort. And I just decided finally, you know, last year to make the effort and go and just as a personal project, not really as an analysis, just sort of just as an observer and to see how they were going and what problems they had. And that's why I say it's a personal film in some ways. But I think the few people that have seen it so far do respond to that, because it's also just a, you know, it's simply a good news story to see young, smart people moving ahead, you know, getting a break. That's really pleasing to me, and I think that comes across.
And you met these students in Cuba, and what were their feelings? How did they feel about the way they were being taught about the experience of living in Cuba?
Yes, well, I met a bunch of them in Timor, because as I said, there's quite a large bunch studying in Timor under the Cubans too.
Oh, okay.
That was in August last year, and they're part of the film too. And then I went to Cuba, and as I said, there's about 700 in Cuba at the moment. We went to the west of Cuba, which is, you've got to understand, the Cuban medical college is really a huge network of colleges. It's the biggest medical college in the world. For example, the biggest single group there would be Cubans, but the biggest group of foreigners there are Bolivians. There's more than 5,000 Bolivians there now, 5,290 something foreign students just from Bolivia. In the area we went to, there were Bolivians, Argentinians, Nicaraguans, and 500 Timorese. So in two quite large colleges, there were about 500 Timorese students in first and second year, and also 20 from Kiribati, one of those little Polynesian islands, in one of the colleges with the Timorese, and getting on very well with the Timorese. So to answer your question, the Timorese students in Cuba, they've got a few problems in the sense that they're a long way from home and they're not going to be able to get a holiday for six or seven years. I mean, the Cubans will pay for everything, but they won't pay for holidays to send them all home. The country's got to do that themselves, and some countries can afford it and some can't. And of course, East Timor's a long way from Cuba, so it's very expensive for anyone to get there. And I'm lucky because usually I get my university to pay my airfares to go and do some research there. So they miss their families. They've had to learn a new language over there. In Timor too, they're studying in Spanish too, so they've had to learn in Timor itself even if they're not in Cuba.
Which is not too different from the Portuguese, I guess.
It's close. So in a sense, certainly the ones that I spoke to, and you'll see it on the film, that the ones that had studied Portuguese, and there are a few, despite what people say here in Australia, Portuguese is a significantly stronger language in Timor today than English is, significantly stronger. And, of course, about 30% or a third of Tetum is Portuguese. So there are some links there. And some are doing it. A lot of them in second year have quite good Spanish now. Even some of them in Timor have quite good Spanish because, as some of their Cuban teachers say, they're polyglots. They're at least on their fourth language. Some of them are on their seventh and eighth language, but they do it. They're very capable, and they're a very conscientious bunch of students too. You can imagine it's a funny sort of atmosphere when you've got hundreds and hundreds of, you know, Argentinians, hundreds and hundreds of Bolivians, hundreds and hundreds of Timorese, and they're all mixing together, you know, after school hours and on the weekends, and they have cultural exchanges and so on.
It'd be a huge multinational experience for them.
Yeah, it is. That's right. I spoke to some North American students, you know, U.S. students in Havana, and the Cubans sort of put them in together in groups of nationality so they can be there with their friends, and to some extent that's to reinforce their culture. Like the Timorese are saying, well, it's because we keep speaking our languages too, and not just Tetum, because one girl I interviewed, she's from the east, and her first language is Fataluku in the east of Timor. And I said, well, how many people speak Fataluku in this college? She said, 17. So at least she's in a very small minority in world terms, but at least she's studying, and she's going to spend years with people who are from her district, you know, of course they speak Tetum amongst each other. But anyway, the American students were saying to me that some of the American students choose to leave the American group and go and stay with the Peruvians or someone else just to improve their Spanish. So it's quite an experience for them. I mean, and some of them, you know, students from New York, they're pretty cosmopolitan, you would think. But this is really cosmopolitan. You know, this is really cosmopolitan to go and, to go and be with that many people mixing together. And of course they're all smart young people too, you know, who are going places, basically.
I've heard that one of the main export earners, I think, or the export industry is sort of medical technology. Even it's not just, you know, the high technology, but just community health care. And the Cubans are now regarded as world leaders in this. But I just saw a little essay by Fidel Castro, he can still write a bloody good essay, but it's called The Elephant and the Ant, and he described this idea the Americans had to compete with the Cubans to send an aircraft carrier converted to a hospital ship, and they sit off the coast of a third world country and spend 10 days there sort of curing people. Now, I suppose you'd be the best person to sort of point out the differences in that approach and what the Cubans are doing.
Yes, well, I mean, they haven't really converted the aircraft carriers. They're actual warships, but because they're warships that with a very big population, I think a lot of them have something like about 5,000 people living on board. They're like small cities, really. Mm. And they do have medical services and, you know, doctors and clinics and all that, dentists and all those sort of things. So they do these little... But it is soldiers in uniform that come and do these sorts of clinics that they do. But, you know, even the capacity to do those sorts of things. Some of them, the U.S. Marines went to Timor actually a few weeks ago and did precisely that. They went in for a few weeks to a few villages and did some dental services and medical services, and they pulled out again. But really, it's pretty small, even though there's a lot of money involved, of course. But, you know, the money of war is sort of all-consuming. I mean, I think the Cubans have said for some years that, look, there's a lot of countries that seem to be able to send thousands of soldiers, you know, and spend millions and millions of dollars to other countries, but there's very few that send thousands of doctors. And that's the point. A lot of medical services, like delivering babies and dealing with tuberculosis and so on, some of these sorts of things are labor intensive, and the Cubans believe in labor intensity and building up human capacity in the countries. It's because, of course, you know, some foreign warship coming in, and it's not really a reliable health service for any country. we can go down the road to the hospital or something if we get sick, you know, and that's the point. You need to have those local services.
Well, I don't know. I'm starting to worry about my teeth at my age. But
come to Cuba, Warwick. It's a lot cheaper to get teeth fixed.
But the... can you put a rough figure on how many people the Cubans are putting out in these kinds of projects? And I know they also do literacy and teaching projects as well that are on the same scale, but just would you have a rough figure on the kind of medical personnel that they put out through the world and that are, I think, very highly appreciated?
Well, globally, I can't tell you exactly, and there's a couple of levels on which it works. You mentioned before about commerce, you know, export industries. It's true that with some countries, in particular Venezuela, the Cubans have a type of commercial deal. It's like a swap where the Cubans have 39,000 health professionals in Venezuela, 39,000. Wow. But that is a commercial swap because they're getting from the Venezuelans to... discount oil, assistance with refineries and their power grid and so on. So there's an exchange going on there. Mm. That's different with Bolivia and Timor-Leste and other countries. It's just simply like you would call it an aid program, basically. They call it a solidarity program. a cooperation. So, putting aside Venezuela for a moment, there's over 1,000 doctors. I'm not sure, 1,000, so many hundred in Bolivia. That would be the biggest program. Then there's very big missions in Guatemala and Nicaragua and Haiti, one of the poorest countries in Latin America, that is to say Nicaragua, Haiti, Bolivia. I would say outside Latin America, the 300 health workers that are in East Timor are probably the biggest single Cuban program and the biggest single health aid program in the world outside Latin America, because the Latin American programs are so big. So there are certainly many, many thousands of Cuban doctors out there. But the interesting thing is, and you can see this from the Timor program, it's not just that they're going out there and doing services. It's they are training 2 to 3 students for every Cuban doctor that's out there. So they want to build a sustainable system that within those countries that they can operate themselves. So with the Timorese students, for example, they expect that the first group, which was 40 or 50 that went in the end of 2003, would start returning to the country at the end of next year, the end of 2009, begin their internships in the country, and progressively, gradually start to move into all of those positions that the Cubans are in, that is to say, rural health services, and then eventually also teaching and probably administration of the system there too.
Yeah, well, I imagine that working on the community level, as the Cubans do, they will gain a lot of expertise and experience in community health care, which they, I imagine, they pass on.
Yeah, well, but also, of course, you have to remember that the health systems, the Cubans focus first of all on primary care and then also on rural areas to a fair degree. They know that's what's been neglected. But their approach is also highly preventive. That is to say, the doctors in rural areas are out there. They do something that most health services don't do. They do house calls. They go around from house to house, particularly where there are ill people, and do house calls. You might remember it used to happen in this country to some extent. Or wasn't there something called a country practice, where a TV program where they did that? But
yeah, you know, I think my mother used to cart me along, or someone would come in and check out that my shots had all been held and I was the right weight and weight for size and all that. But they don't do that now.
So they still do that because they aren't driven by this economic rationalism to maximise the amount of income you get out of a given group of people. So they're doing that in Timor at the moment. They're doing house visits. I open up with a black Cuban doctor in the east of Timor doing a house visit to an old man there. And then that old man's granddaughter is in Cuba studying medicine. So that's why I say there's a personal touch to this. So they focus on preventive medicine, and they get the students also to go out at the beginning of their training and study what the problems are in the area. Now, the health problems in Timor are very different to the health problems in Cuba. And the health system in Timor is very different to the health system in Cuba. So on the one hand, the Cubans have to get used to the system in Timor. And then, of course, when the Timorese students who study in Timor are studying their own health problems in their own system, the ones that are studying in Cuba, of course, are have practical experience in the Cuban context, but they're not dealing with malaria and tuberculosis, because the malaria and tuberculosis hardly exist in Cuba. Malaria doesn't exist and tuberculosis hardly exists. But when they come back to Timor, they're very big issues. So, there's a lot to learn between different systems, but they also need to, the Cubans encourage them very much to study their own system and their own problems, the problems of housing, the particular environmental problems and so on. That's part of what they stress with their primary healthcare people, who spend a lot of time on preventive health. Of course, the very privatized systems are very extremely, extremely low on preventive health. The more private practice, the more you have a focus on curative health. You go there when you've got a problem, they give you some drugs or do a procedure, those sorts of things. So it's only around the world it's the same thing. It's the public systems or public doctors that carry all the weight of preventive health, dealing with the vector problems of malaria and other infectious diseases, for example. Also being there for women who are having babies, for example. That's also something that's an absolute sort of preventive issue, you know, examining women who are during their pregnancy, seeing what the problems are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's more of treating the causes of bad health rather than plastering over the symptoms. And
yeah, there's something in Latin American tradition which is called social medicine, and it's not really the same as public health as we know it here, but the Germans talk about it too, and the Latin Americans talk about it, and that great former president of Chile, Salvador Allende, was one of the main proponents in the 20th century. And social medicine really means that most of what you're talking about in terms of illnesses, particularly in developing countries with nutrition, infectious diseases, illegal abortion, a whole range of issues, even addictions and so on, are the result of social conditions. So you have to address those social conditions as a means of improving the health of the population. It's not enough for a group of people to come in on an aircraft carrier or any other sort of vehicle and do a few little, you know, procedures and hand out some drugs. That's not really how you improve the health of a population or build a healthy society.
Mm. Now, just before you go, Tim, I know Fred Hollows got some award, very highly respected, and I think he tried to run a similar kind of, he ran on a similar kind of philosophy, you know, and cured a lot of blindness in the outback, in the Aboriginal communities, and I believe the Cubans are running a similar program certainly in Venezuela and other third world countries, and I'm just wondering if, you know, is there a connection there, and is there any likelihood that the Australian government could sort of take up the banner of Fred Hollows? And
well, I mean, you may have seen advertisements around the country. I believe it's the Fred Hollows Foundation, which is independent of the government, but they raise funds, and they've done a lot of very good work, not just in Australia, but in other countries too, with free eye operations. So it's like an aid project where I think they advertise that, look, this simple eye operation costs $25 and so on. So it is indeed a parallel program. It's a very good program. The Cubans, with the assistance of the Venezuelans, have been doing it in Latin America mainly, like for Operation Miracle. They've done over 1 million free operations. So they've been funding it themselves with the help of the Venezuelans and other people who've provided transport, for example. It's spread outside Cuba now that they do it in hospitals in other parts of Latin America too. So it's a parallel program. The Fred Hollows Foundation has a very good program also. I'm not sure the scale of it. Certainly the scale of the one in Latin America, Operation Miracle, is massive. And because I think at the start of the program they estimated there was 5 million people in Latin America with curable blindness. They're now, I think they've treated about a quarter of those people, but there are new cases coming along of cataracts every year. So they as I say, it's a numbers game in terms of training large numbers of health professionals, and they believe in that sort of labor intensity. And they believe in public systems too, with universal access. And there's some important ideas, I think, for other people.
Yeah, I mean, relatively low-tech, community-oriented, socially-oriented medical programs. Look, that's great news, Tim, and thanks very much for telling us about and talking about it. And I'm sure you'll get in touch with us as soon as your DVD is available. We'll try and show it here.
It's going to gradually get around, yeah.
Yeah. And and you are going back to East Timor very soon. Could you comment very quickly on what you'll be doing on this trip?
Yes. Well, I always do a little bit of research when I travel. But one of the things I'll do is to take my little video over to show, of course, to the families of the students here in Cuba who haven't seen their children for a few years in some cases. We're trying to make, I hope we will before I go in about 3 weeks, finalise the Tetum version of it, so we'll have a version subtitled in Tetum so that it's easier for them to follow it, because there's multiple languages in this whole process, of course. At the moment, what we've done here is the version subtitled in English, but we'll have the Tetum version, I hope, before I go next month.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, that's great work, Tim. I know myself what a pain it is getting some of this material translated. But look, thanks very much for talking to Latin Radical and Community Radio, TuneIn FM. And good luck on your next trip.
Thanks a lot.